Colonel Smiley, Regal 3.
Going on about Glubb, he definitely used to recruit from the opposition. A lot of these men in the Iraqi army were from different tribes. Some had probably kith and kin in Glubb's legion anyway, so they were quite happy to sort of change sides. There wasn't any ill feeling about it at all. I think they probably preferred to serve him than the Iraqis.
What kind of impression on you did Glubb make, personally?
He was a very quiet, modest, small man, with his very noticeable chin, which wasn't, I mean, a lot of it shot away or something, he's almost chinless. But he was great fun to talk to, and he was altogether, and of course seeing him with his Arabs, they absolutely worshipped him, there's no doubt about that. I mean, they'd do anything for him. But he was a very good ally to us in that particular campaign.
I think that we've missed out the actual relieving of Habania.
Yes. You were asking about Habania. Well, we surrounded it, and we had a whole brigade and a battalion of the Essex Regiment, and eventually, I think, one or two of our aircraft, some very old ones, bombed it, and the Iraqis withdrew towards Baghdad, and we followed them up. And then, from then on, our target was Baghdad itself, which is where Rashid Ali and his pro-German government were supposed to be. And also, I think our embassy there wasn't under some form of siege as well. But anyway, we followed up down the railway line, and eventually Baghdad I think it surrendered. That's quite right. They did surrender, the Iraqis, at Baghdad. And at that moment, half my regiment, a squadron, or more than a squadron, was detached from the regiment which was in Baghdad. And we were told to go to Mosul. And we formed a column which was called Gokol, because our commanding officer was somebody called Colonel Eric Gooch. He wasn't then, he was a major. Major Eric Gooch, he was in charge of this column. It included a troop of 25-pounders, and I think we had some Gurkhas with us as well. Anyway, we shot up to Mosul, where, in fact, there were quite a lot of German aircraft on the airfield there. There were Heinkels, and you could see that the German markings had been overpainted with the Iraqi markings, but they had German pilots and German ground personnel, but they'd all buzzed off before we got there. They went off to Turkey. They went off to Turkey, and when we got to Mosul, we camped there some days. I had a very interesting job. I was told to go off with my troop and try and cut the road leading from Iraq into Turkey. And to do this, I had to go past a very old city called Erbil and then up a gorge called the Roendouz Gorge. And I went right up practically to the Turkish frontier. And it was the most lovely country. It was all inhabited by Kurds. It was in what you might call Kurdistan, because the unfortunate Kurds, as you know, have got they live partly in Turkey and partly in Iraq and partly in Persia. All three countries are absolutely beastly to them. And, of course, they want to have a Kurdistan of their own, which causes complications even to these days. But anyway, the Kurds were very friendly, and we made a block on the road because the German ambassador in Baghdad is called Dr. Grobber, and he's the man who really instigated this rising, anti-British rising with Rashid Ali and co. And he was supposed to be fleeing to Turkey, and I was supposed to block the road and catch him. But in point of fact, after spending a week up there, and it was absolutely lovely fishing and beautiful rivers and mountains, we were called back. We had wireless sets, and I was called back. And apparently Dr. Grobber had escaped to Turkey about 4 days before I'd actually got to the place. So there was I was catching he'd escaped already. But still, it was a very fascinating patrol. And after that, Iraqi sort of campaign had come to an end. I mean, it was a very quick thing. I mean, it took more than about 3 weeks, the whole operation. Seems
you give the impression that it was something of a pushover.
Yes. They fought a bit at the beginning, and then they packed up fairly quickly. They fought quite well, the Iraqis, in fact. But they collapsed very quickly, and I don't think they need have done. Of course, there were some people, some Iraqis, fighting on our side. There was a regiment there called the Assyrian Levies, and they remained loyal, and they supported us, although they were Iraqi recruited. But, no, it seemed to pack up very quickly. There was just sort of mopping up operations, like dashing off to Mosul to see if you could catch any Germans, and quite a few Iraqi officers tried to escape to Turkey, and in fact, we caught one staff car with about four of them beetling for the border, and we stopped them and arrested them. I don't know what happened to them eventually. I think it was all over very quickly. But then we had, before a matter of weeks, I can't remember what the timing was, we were then engaged in fighting the French in Syria, and our particular brigade had to advance into Syria from Iraq. And I remember my first sort of recollections of it was how we were bombed by the French as we advanced. We had to spread ourselves in the desert, sort of artillery formation, what you call artillery formation, or sort of against bombing. We each car kept about 200 yards away from the other car, and these bombers used to come over every day and usually knocked out two or three trucks and killed two or three people. It was quite unpleasant because we never saw a British airplane at all. And we advanced towards Palmyra, and actually I did a patrol. First thing I did, first sort of active thing I did, I suppose, was leading a patrol into Palmyra, where we did actually capture a man from the Foreign Legion, literally with his trousers down, in the very early hours of the morning, about 5 in the morning, and then I had to withdraw. I was only with a sort of about 12 men, and the French saw us and opened up on us with machine guns and things, and we had to sort of beat rather a hasty retreat, running and dropping, till we got back. But that was the first sort of bit of active thing I did in Syria. But then I went down with malaria outside Palmyra. We hadn't taken it. We encircled it. We encircled two or three places, and the French did in fact surrender one or two sort of Bogis forts on another pumping station line called the T line, which went to Tripoli. It was, again, there were pumping stations T1, T2, T3, T4, and these pumping stations really consisted of a little sort of Bogis fort enclosing the pumping installations and sort of living quarters, and they usually had water, and sometimes they had a refrigerator, and they were always a nice thing to capture if you could. But outside Palmyra I got malaria, and I was put in a cave, and I remember watching from my cave the most extraordinary thing. We'd been bombed by the French every day, and they were usually the same six bombers. They were called Glen Martins. They were American bombers supplied by the Americans, and they were dropping British bombs because we'd supplied the French in Syria. They were our allies. But when the French packed up, the French colonial troops in Syria declared for Pétain and wouldn't come over to De Gaulle. And so we were literally fighting them. Fairly dirty fighters they were too, I might add, on occasions.
In what way?
Well, I remember one particular occasion. It wasn't my regiment, thank goodness. It was a yeomanry regiment. They surrounded one of these tea pumping stations and called on the French to surrender, which they had done in one case to our regiment, in another case to another. And the French said they would and came out with a white flag, and the troop went forwards, possibly not too carefully. They thought the French had surrendered, and when they got within range, they dropped the white flag and opened up on them and killed about half the people there. I think they got that French officer eventually and court-martialed him, but it was nasty business. And also, they certainly shot up our ambulances, because I was in one being shot up on my way back from Palmyra. But I think the thing which impressed me most and gave us a most tremendous boost in morale was when these six Glen Martins came over one morning, and out of the sky, out of the sun, came some what we thought were British fighters and shot down all six at the same time. And I remember seeing three aircraft in the air blazing at the same time and parachutes opening in all directions. One parachute was on fire, and anyway, we cheered ourselves hoarse and all those bombers were shot down. It later turned out, in fact, the airplanes were Tomahawks and they belonged to the Royal Australian Air Force. They were Australians. But anyway, we were absolutely delighted. But I was taken away in an ambulance that night, and in the ambulance with me was a French pilot who'd come down in a parachute which was blazing, so he'd hit the ground pretty hard. In fact, he died in the ambulance that night. I was rather sorry for the poor devil, really. He was badly burnt as well. But then we had a long trek back from Palmyra, the wounded people, and not only wounded, quite a lot of cases of malaria. And we went to Nazareth, but on the way to Nazareth we were attacked by French fighters. And I mean, our ambulances were clearly marked, and they came down and riddled two or three of them with bullets. They didn't kill anybody, actually, because most of the people jumped out, and I didn't jump out of mine. I feel too bloody ill, but most people did. But I remember having a terrible journey back to Nazareth, not only being attacked by the French. There's also a rather unpleasant character called Fawzi al-Kawakchi, who was a sort of guerrilla leader who had been, I think he'd been in the Turkish army originally, but he was very anti-British, and he'd been one of the leading troublemakers in Palestine. I think he was sort of right-hand man of the Mufti or something. And he was leading sort of groups of irregulars and beating up our sort of rear echelons and things. And he had quite a certain amount of success in sort of cutting off odd vehicles and killing all the occupants and things. And when we were going back to Palestine from Iraq, no, from Syria, sorry, we didn't get much protection because all the troops were needed. We were always worried this wretched man would be on our tail, sort of knocking off the odd straggler. But luckily he never did. We got back perfectly well. But I had a very bad journey because we had to keep the... It was all sand and dust. And with the door shut, it would have been all right. But I had a trooper of my regiment who had the extraordinary name of Flood Paddock. And Flood Paddock was 6'7". He was about the tallest man in the regiment. And he was so big, his feet had to stick out the door, so they had to keep the door open for his feet to stick out. So we were in a permanent sort of cloud of dust. But anyway, we got to Nazareth. That was the first sort of medical hospital we went to. We'd been to we had a sort of field dressing station out in the desert. And I must say it was lovely getting into a bed and having a sort of bath. And apart from the fact the orderlies pinched my pistol and my compass and things, apart from that, I was very well looked after. Then I was taken another. I stayed a few days at Nazareth and then went in a train down to Sarafand, where I spent 3 weeks in a hospital.
How long did it take you to recover?
After 3 weeks I went back to my regiment. I didn't have any... later in life I had several relapses, but basically at that moment I think it was about 3 weeks before. I did have a week's leave. I had 2 weeks in hospital, I think, and a week's leave. I went to Cairo. In fact, I remember in Cairo I wanted to get back to the regiment, and I didn't know where they were because they'd been moving when I left them. In fact, I asked at two or three places. I asked GHQ, and nobody knew where they were, and I asked British troops in Egypt, nobody knew where they were. And somebody said to me, why don't you go out and ask the barman at Shepherd's? He knows where every regiment is. So I went to the barman at Shepherd's and I said, can you tell me where the House of Cavalry regiment is? He said, oh yes, they're up in Syria, they're at Aleppo now. And he's quite right, and I went, got on a train, got back to Aleppo and rejoined the regiment. I mean, as simple as that.
Was he an Egyptian?
No, I think he was probably an Italian or something like that. I can't, he might have been, no, what was he? He might have been a Cypriot or a Greek or something. No, I think I can't remember what nationality he was quite a character, and he was a dark fellow. I think he was more likely a Greek or something like that. Couldn't have been Italian because they're all interned by then. Anyway, I rejoined the regiment at Aleppo, and I was just in time to rejoin them for their next little sort of operation, which was the invasion of Persia.
What date is this now, approximately?
In August 1941, I rejoined the regiment at Aleppo, and we were then heard that we were going to advance into Persia, where the Shah was suspected of being pro-German and having German aircraft and things based on his country. And it was quite a big operation. It was more than a division, I think. Well, it was a complete division, I think, we were with. And we were split up, and our division went to a place called Kermanshah first. We crossed the frontier, and there was very little opposition. The Persian army literally ran away and didn't fight at all. The only people who fired any shots at us at all were the gendarmerie, the police. They had a bit more guts, but basically it was a sort of procession, really. And when we got outside Tehran, we made contact with the Russians who had a, I don't know if it was a division or a brigade, came from the north. It was part of the Caucasian division. And we met them before Tehran was occupied and made a plan to occupy it the next day. And, of course, they double-crossed us and occupied it that night, so they got there first. We got in the next day, and we went, my particular squadron was billeted in a machine gun factory where the machine guns were of German make. I mean, they were made in Tehran, but they were Mausers and Spandaus and things. They were definitely sort of based on German weapons. I think they had German technicians. But anyway, we occupied Persia. We had a very big parade jointly with the Russians. We had the House Hill Cavalry and the Gurkhas on parade, and the Russians paraded. They were frightfully smart in sort of, really, they had sort of butcher boots and epaulettes and gold, and they were extremely smart. We were all in our desert kit, which just consisted of a pair of shorts and a khaki shirt and a ghastly-looking topi, which we had to wear in those days, and we looked quite awful. I got photographs this day of all those parades. I photographed my war from beginning to the end. I got endless albums I took of that stage of the war. Anyway, we marched past. We were inspected by General Novikov, who was the Caucasian army commander, and we were very friendly. I mean, they came to parties in our sort of mess, and we went over to them, and we sang the International Now, and they sang God Save the King and Eton boating song things, and we were mostly drunk on vodka anyway, because vodka flowed very freely in Tehran in those days. And of course the Persian army was absolutely pathetic, it was useless, and the officers, when we saw them, were like out of a musical comedy. I mean, they wore sort of Nazi-type hats and butcher boots and were heavily scented. I thought they were awful, frankly, the Persian army. I thought it was absolutely useless. And we upseated the Shah. I'm not sure what we did with him. I think we sent him into exile to an island or something, and eventually replaced him with his son. But it was a very nice, sort of easy time, that particular. We stayed in Tehran quite a long time. And it was really rather lovely. And
what kind of military impression did the Russian forces in Tehran make?
They looked rather smart. They were white Russians in complexion, I mean, because later on I had a lot to do with Russians in Albania, and they were all Asiatic ones. They were all Tajiks and Uzbeks and Kazakhs and God knows what. But these were definitely from the Soviet of Russia rather than from one of the many other countries they have in the Soviet Union. And they were very smart and gave a good impression, really. And they were very friendly too. As I say, it was the first contact between British and Russian troops in the war. There was a war correspondent up there. There were two, in fact. One was Richard Dimbleby, and he was very helpful because he had a very good room in the only room in one of the hotels in Tehran, which had a bath, and he used to allow us to come and have a bath in his bathroom. It was about the first bath. Washing facilities in those campaigns was, you managed to shave and not much else. You know, you didn't have much to wash with. If there was a river, you could have a bit of a bathe, you know, but it was rather nice to have a hot bath, which we did in Richard Dimbleby's bathroom, I remember that. But they were rather good. I mean, we dined and wined, and I must say there was a certain amount of wine, women and song in those days, you know.
What was the attitude of the local population towards the British forces?
They were terribly cowed, but I don't think they were cowed by us. I think they were cowed by their ruler. They were absolutely pathetic. First of all, they were made to dress in European clothes, which looked completely out of place on a sort of Arab. I don't say that they're pure Arabs, they're not, but they're sort of dark-skinned, and seeing them wearing flat hats and bowler hats and sort of old uniforms from different armies and extraordinary sort of civilian clothes, I mean European clothes, it looked terribly out of place, and they were terribly thin, and I thought they were very sort of poor specimens. True, no doubt, starvation and the way they'd been brought up. I mean, the Shah's rule was very autocratic. I mean, I think there were some big landlords, and these wretched people had to give so much percent of their crops to the landlord, probably didn't have enough to live on and all that sort of thing. They were very degenerate altogether, the officers and people. I had a very low opinion, in fact, of the Persians at that time, but later on I had dealings with Persians in Yemen. The last Shah sent me some officers from the Persian army to be trained in guerrilla warfare with me in the Yemen where I was in the 1960s. And they were absolutely first class. They were quite a different type. I mean, since after that was all over and the war was all over and they started building up again, they were trained by the British and the Americans and different people, and they became very good. But the ones we fought against, luckily for us, weren't. And after that, when the thing was all over, we did do one or two patrols. I don't know what for quite. I remember spending 2-3 days at a place called Senna, where we used to go out on pig shoots, and it was it was more of a sporting occasion than a war, really. But then we went back to Palestine and were based in Jerusalem. But I didn't get back to Palestine with the regiment, because again I went down with malaria, and I went into hospital in Habaneer, actually. I was put in a hospital there for a bit, and then I rejoined the regiment based in Jerusalem, and I think that's where we spent the Christmas of 1942. Yes, it was Christmas 42 we spent in Jerusalem, and it was there that we heard that we might eventually get either Bren carriers or armoured cars, because we'd still been in these wretched 1,500-weight trucks, which was not very exciting things to go to war in. We were really more mounted infantry than anything else. We weren't mechanised. And it was rather a sort of poor type of unit to be in. And when we were in Jerusalem, we had to raise a squadron, a composite squadron, and send it to the Western Desert to become dummy tanks. And I was in the squadron, and it was really a fascinating time of the war. We went, because the front line then extended from Tobruk to Bir Hakeim. That was sort of where we'd been. The war in the desert had gone up and down. Our front lines fluctuated. Rommel attacked and drove us back, and then we counterattacked and drove him, and went toing and froing. But that's where they were when we went up with our dummy tanks, which I might add were Ford 3-ton chassis with sort of 3-plywood bodies, skirts made of canvas to resemble tracks, and a drain pipe sticking out of the front to resemble a gun, And in the distance, in fact, they did look like a tank, but of course from the air, they didn't leave tracks. They could tell at once it wasn't a tank, so we had to have one or two real tanks with us. We were representing, in those days, Crusaders, A-15, I think it was called, and we had two, three Crusaders with us who swanned about, and we then always parked our dummy tanks in the tracks of the real tanks. That was so that aerial photographs wouldn't give the thing away. And we got quite involved in the various fighting, not merely by being bombed and shelled and machine gunned by fighters. Stukas in particular used to come down, beat us up, but we were doing our job of diverting attacks from somewhere else, and we were used either in a diversionary role or else sometimes we were static, sometimes we moved. But it was quite what we did do when we were there, that every officer in my the composite squadron, we represented a squadron of tanks, as it were, and every officer did an attachment to the Royals. Now, in the Western Desert at that time, there's no doubt about it, the best armoured car regiment was the 11th Hussars. They were absolutely outstanding. And the 11th Hussars trained the Royals to be armoured cars, and we in our turn, all the officers and senior NCOs, went to the Royals to be trained in armoured car work. And when the dummy tank thing finished, we went back to rejoin the regiment, which had by then gone to Cyprus, and there we were issued with our first armoured cars, which we remained until the end of the war. In fact, even when I commanded my regiment in 1952, we still had armoured cars. We became an armoured car regiment from that moment on, but that's how it started, training, being trained by the Royals, who in fact had been trained by the 11th Hussars, and they were the two best regiments in the desert, best armoured car regiment I'm referring to. And when we went to Cyprus, we trained madly with these new armoured cars called Marmon Harringtons.
Called what?
Marmon Harrington. Marmon Harrington was the bits, I think, were built by Fords in America, and they were assembled in South Africa, and the South Africans produced the cars, and then they were very good in the desert in that they travelled over the sand extremely well, but they had such thin armour that a bullet would go through it, from an armour-piercing bullet would penetrate the armour, and the gun was so small that we couldn't take on the German tanks or armoured cars. In fact, our role was required.